Hey guys, welcome to this episode of Unemployable. Today we have a really special chat with Bram, who is a Bitcoiner, has been around the space for a long time. We had a really deep and meaningful chat about what Bitcoin is, why people need to be paying attention to it, how it's brought peace and fulfillment and a brighter future to his life. He spends a lot of his time educating and inspiring millennials to learn about Bitcoin. And it was just one of the most pleasurable chats I've had in a long time around this particular topic. So with that said, if you do enjoy the content, remember, like, subscribe, comment, and most importantly, tell your friends to watch it. Flick the link forward because this stuff is just so valuable into improving the quality of people's lives. With that said, let's get into this awesome interview with Bram. G'day, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of Unemployable. Again, this is a Bitcoin-focused session, and today we are joined by Bram Canstein, who has a really cool YouTube channel specifically on Bitcoin and with a real focus on educating millennials into this space. Bram, welcome to the pod. How are you doing?
Hey, Adam. Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me. Happy to chat.
Yeah. So, look, I'm glad that you came on. You've got a great channel. You've had some of the biggest names in Bitcoin on the channel. You've obviously dedicated a lot of time and energy to it. Maybe you could just give us a little bit of background, like where are you based? What drew you into Bitcoin initially? What has been your Bitcoin story?
Oh yeah, I'm thinking where to start. Like I am from Western Europe. I discovered Bitcoin in 2013, early 2013. I was a student back then. I had a friend who sent me a video, which it was just a very informational video. I think it was called something like How Bitcoin Works. It was like an animation video that was on YouTube. Unfortunately, it's private now, so I cannot link anyone to it again. But when I saw that video, I think the first thing that I thought about, you know, being like someone who grew up in the 90s, having, you know, the first type of internet and mobile phone, and I was always online just trying out new stuff and just going down different rabbit holes and internet journeys, you know, like really surfing the internet, basically. My mother always calling upstairs like, hey, do you want to get off the internet? Like, I need to call, you know, like I was just a classic internet kid geek, you know. So I was always looking for like, okay, what is happening? Like, what are new things that people are working on? And when I saw that video of Bitcoin, yeah, the first thoughts I had was like, oh, this is like a money for the internet, you know, like a currency for the internet. And so I've looked at it, especially from the beginning, more from like the technological angle, like, okay, this is apparently possible. And I think I bought my first Bitcoin, yeah, between like $100 and $300 or something. And I always share that, not to flex, because I sold everything at $4,000 also. You know, at that time that was an amazing decision. You know, I felt really, really good. Yesterday I tweeted something like, you gotta fumble before you get humble, you know, like you when you don't realize what this is, and it takes quite some time, I think, to understand why Bitcoin exists and what it's what is its place in the world, you know, what is the problem that it solves for us, then you're going to look at it, I would say, yeah, I don't know another word than wrong, but like from the wrong angle, right? Like I looked at it from an investment perspective. I looked at it from like just a technological perspective. So I got distracted a lot. I even held a presentation about Litecoin at a big bank after a guy who did a presentation about Bitcoin at the same event at the bank, you know. And so I was like, oh, this is newer and faster or whatever. I don't even know what my reasoning was with Litecoin. But eventually I also got into, you know, Ethereum at like, I don't know, $17 or 70, something like that. Just really early, just messing around, you know, like trying out, okay, like what is this crypto stuff, ICOs, NFTs, all that stuff. And it took me quite some time to realize that Bitcoin is the only thing to focus on, and I think that also came because you know, like the past 10-12 years, so my career, like my working career, has been on like the edge of like new innovations, startups, digital businesses, and then really like early stage focus. So basically the 0 to 1 phase. So yeah, I have an idea. How do I know if it's good enough? How do I go out in the market to gather information to see if my idea is actually good enough? And yeah, I've worked with, I think over 200 teams and entrepreneurs just really on that first phase. And why it took me quite some time is to realize that I think one of my core phrases is, just because you can build something doesn't mean you should. You know, like you can have, I believe there's an infinite amount of ideas just floating around, and sometimes you get a download, right? But that doesn't mean it's actually a good idea. Like you have to go out into the world and let the market decide if, you know, this is something that actually should exist. But many people, you know, they just start building their idea, or they hide themselves for a year, they build some sort of product or service, and then they launch it and say, you know, like, hey, here I am, you know, buy my thing. But you know, that's one of the biggest, I think, lessons I've learned, and what I've also seen a lot of people do is doing exactly just that, right? Whereas if you go out into the market, you gather information, you test your own assumptions, your own beliefs, you know, about your idea. An idea is nothing more than a combination of assumptions and beliefs that you have, you know, packaged in some sort of proposition that you have. But yeah, if you don't do that in a diligent enough way, you will waste time, energy, and resources on the wrong idea, which eventually, you know, is like the worst thing that you can do. And so once I kind of learned that through my career, I came to the point where, I built some startups before, failed at a lot, sold a few. I wanted to work on a crypto startup. So something in the crypto space. And I wanted to combine the lack of market research that a lot of startups did in general, but especially in the crypto space, combine that with the insight that many people in the crypto space are actually early adopters. So I thought, okay, I'm going to make a market research platform for crypto, because I think, you know, this is where people will build upon in the future. So I teamed up with a friend. We built this kind of like task platform, like startups could put on like, hey, this is my, you know, beta version of a startup or of my product. Can you try it out? Answer these 5 questions and you can earn, you know, 10, 20 USDC or whatever. And in 6 months, I talked to over 100 teams and entrepreneurs building in the crypto space. And we did like 50 of these campaigns. And eventually I realized that all these people were making the same mistakes that I've seen, you know, Web2 type startup people make for the past 10 years. And they were really drawn to the fact that, you know, there was so much money and so much funding going on that they were just like, yeah, but I got funding, you know, I'm just going to build this thing. And they didn't really see value in getting insights from early users. And yeah, after doing that for 6 months, I just realized, wow, I've been looking. So this was like 3-ish years ago. I've been looking at crypto at that time for like 5-6 years, and nothing has really come out of it. You know, like there are some market maker or like, you know, these bridge platforms like SushiSwap or whatever, which is logical because people need to swap and, you know, there's some value in that. But like really killer apps, you know, like I've heard all the use cases, but they aren't there. And when I realized that, you know, and along the way, of course, like I was still studying Bitcoin, listening to, you know, Bitcoin podcasts and stuff. But then I just realized, hey, but Bitcoin is just totally other thing. And then I actually went back to what was I thinking about? What was I thinking around Bitcoin in 2013 and 14? So I went on Twitter. I searched, you know, I've been on Twitter for, I don't know, 14, 15 years or something. I searched in advanced search for tweets from myself about Bitcoin. And then I found like a tweet from 2013 that said something like, Bitcoin is a synthesized commodity, a digital synthesized commodity that you can trade with anyone in the world 24/7, 365. And I was like, holy shit, like I got it, but I didn't get it, you know? And that's, that was kind of one of my trigger points to kind of like dive deeper and focus only on Bitcoin. And it was that and a few moments also in... I had a little spin-off in like TradFi in the innovation department at two big banks, where I learned about, you know, fractional reserve banking, money system, you know, money in a bank is not yours, stuff like that. And so about 3-4-ish years ago, I really started diving in more like the financial and economic, yeah, backgrounds or, you know, and the environment wherein Bitcoin was launched and why it should exist. And yeah, I think that's the core. Like you can pitch Bitcoin to someone, but that is a solution. And I've come to realize that many people have no clue what their problem basically is, right? And so I think we should talk about the problem more before we can even pitch the solution. And I think, yeah, the core of the problem is that no one really understands what money is, but we're using it anyway.
Yeah. So you've had a really interesting journey. Thank you for sharing that, because I think a lot of young people, your market that you focus on a lot is focusing on millennials, and they tend to, you know, they've got very active minds, and so they go in all sorts of directions, and these altcoins or shitcoins, whatever you want to call them, can be really appealing. But in my mind, they're all tech startups trying to find product market fit and trying to find a use case. And I just came back from Paris Blockchain Week to see if I could figure out the use case for a lot of these things. And I came away after a week still unclear on where any product market fit outside of, you know, stable coins maybe. But let's talk about the problem, because
agree, that, by the way.
What's that?
I fully agree.
Yeah. I mean, when AI came along, we got to see all of a sudden, you know, AI has been around for a while, but it's sort of gone mainstream the last 3 years. But in that time, we've seen so many product market fits. We've seen so many use cases for it in real world show up. But crypto's had a lot longer, and we just haven't seen those product market fits in the same clear cut way. But let's talk about that problem, Bram, because, you know, you and I as Bitcoiners, I've been around Bitcoin since 2017, and the longest stay around it, and I had a similar journey, but I probably didn't go as far down the altcoin road as you. I maybe owned 5 or 6 and then finally figured out, oh, Bitcoin's the only one, right? Like now, and then I went much deeper on Bitcoin.
I only ever owned Ethereum, actually, and maybe like 2 side things of Ethereum, but no Cardano, no all that stuff. I think the trading part was clear to me. Like, I'm not a trader. You know, when I discovered Bitcoin, I traded for like 3, 4, 5 months, almost daily. And then after that, I realized I'm way too emotional to be a trader. Like, I'm not a trader guy. So with all the crypto stuff, I wasn't really trading. It was more about finding opportunities or something. But I think that's also at the core of what you are alluding to. I think, you know, like, it's why I'm focusing on millennials is basically because, you know, I think everything, I realized that everything that has been sold to us, like in not in a bad way, you know, but like from our parents and stuff, like, you know, this is how you build your life. Like, you go to school, you learn something, you get a job, and you know, you buy a house, you start a family, you know, all these things are still things that everyone wants. But it's just not attainable in this time anymore, you know. And when I realized that, and it was actually, you know, this moment I earlier mentioned at the bank where I worked at, I had a colleague that at one point told me, you know, did you know that the money in the bank is not yours? And I was like, what? You know, like, I was 30, I had a mortgage, I was working at a bank, you know, and then I had someone tell me, did you know the money in the bank is not yours? And I was like, oh, sorry, but what do you mean? And then we had like lunch for an hour, and he explained fractional reserve banking to me. And so, which basically is, you know, when you put money in the bank, you lend it out to the bank. The bank tries to make more money from it because they have a big pile of money, right? And if that goes well and they make money, you don't see any upside. You know, maybe a little percentage on your savings account, but that is not comparable to what they earn with it. But when it goes wrong, you know, like with the great financial crisis, which all the millennials have experienced in some way or another, yeah, then the losses get socialized, basically, through whatever route, right? Like, if there's a bailout by the government, you know, the money from the government comes from the citizens, so they need to create more money, which eventually inflates prices, you know. So I walked away from that conversation feeling like an idiot. You know, like, I'm participating in a system that I don't understand. I feel like I'm an actor, you know, like, I got a mortgage, I got a house, I'm doing the things. But then I realized I was more like a subject. You know, I wasn't really acting. I was just following some sort of, you know, maybe dogma is a strong word, but just a way to build your life, which everyone is doing. That's why you're doing it. But then when I realized that I was participating in something that I totally didn't understand, I think that was really a light bulb moment, and also a trigger for me to kind of like, yeah, again, like dive more into that economic and financial part of first my life, you know, and then broader, you know, like how does this work? What is money? Where does that come from? What is debt? What is ownership, property, all these things? And then when I started comparing that to Bitcoin, I realized that this is a parallel system in which the money that you use cannot be debased. And later I realized, okay, but what does that imply, right? And I think I like to use the time preference a lot. So that's, I don't know if that's coined by Saif Dinamous, who's the author of the Bitcoin Standard, but he talks about it in a great way, which is, you know, everyone has uncertainty around the future. Like we could go outside after this, you know, talk and could get run over by a car and I'm dead. You know, like I don't know how long I have, like how much time I have. So my time is absolutely finite with an unknown quantity, basically. And so everyone has uncertainty around the future. So what do you do day by day? You know, you try to add some value to the world, get a reward, and use that reward to lower your uncertainty towards the future. And you can do that by saving, but you know, just to have like a nest egg. But you can also do that by saving because you eventually want to invest, maybe, you know, become unemployable, you know, build your own business or start a family or move somewhere or whatever you want to do to lower your uncertainty towards the future. And when I understood that the thing that you're saving, the units of money, you know, that we call fiat money, dollars or euros or any money in the world, is basically debased on purpose. So it's becoming, you know, the value is dropping every minute, basically, but it's a very, very tiny, tiny amount. So you don't feel it. Even yearly, you don't feel it, right? Like the financial system is designed to lose 2% of value of all the money every year. So you're incentivized to spend, you know, this is a whole nother podcast, even like people thinking that's a good idea or not, you know, types of economics. But I realized, okay, so if I'm using the money that's constantly losing value, when I get home from my job or my venture, you know, and this is for anyone, having a job or doing a venture is taking risk. You know, you make a choice to do something with your finite time and energy. When you come home and you have a certain amount of the reward that you got, you still have to take more risk to mitigate the debasement of the reward that you got. And when I realized that that actually gives you anxiety, even, you know, unconsciously heightens your uncertainty towards the future. When I then studied Bitcoin, I realized, hey, this is a money that cannot be debased. This money also has an absolute finite supply, just as my time. So it's a way better measure of my own expenditure of my energy and time that I get rewarded for, that I can then save this economic power in towards the future, which actually helps me lower my uncertainty towards the future, which I later realized helps you live more in the now, which I think is eventually the goal of everyone.
So you sort of ended up in quite a spiritual place, really, with that journey.
That's why we are blessed with Bitcoin.
Yeah, I like that. It's interesting. When I do spend time with Bitcoiners who've been around it for a while, I notice two things: a lack of ego and a sense of calm. And those two things are quite powerful and valuable and are nice to be around. People with a lack of ego and a sense of calm.
I would have described myself as a control freak before and a risk-averse person, you know. So I want to understand what I'm doing. That's why when I walked away from that conversation, I just felt like an idiot, you know, like, what are you doing? You know, like, okay, I'm doing something in a system and exchanging value with people with a money that is controlled by other people that don't really care about my own individual life as much as I care about my own individual life, right? So how can I have agency? How can I have control of what I'm doing in my life, you know, like how can I make the best decisions at that best time when, if those decisions revolve around my my wealth, my money, my ideas for the future, my wishes, whatever. Basically, and for a lot of people, this will be strong. And I think I'm also surprised I'm saying stuff like this now when I look back from the last 5 years. But you don't really have free will in that sense. You know, like you can do whatever you want, you know, like that is fine. But the thing you are using to get rewarded for your finite time and energy is something that other people, no smarter or better than you, can create out of nothing. So that is the dumbest trade that you can do in your life. And when I realized that, yeah, I just wanted to, I didn't want to do that. So, you know, I think that has been a big trigger for me. And when I look back now or how I view Bitcoin, you know, people think Bitcoin is risky or they look at it as some sort of speculative investment. For me, again, as a former self-defined control freak, I think this is the most rational thing that you can do to save your economic energy and to lower your uncertainty towards the future. And so that is really the arc that I went through. And I do feel that I'm living more in the now, that I am very optimistic about the future, that I'm looking forward to the future, that you know, I just had a baby, like I want to build a bigger family, you know, like stuff like that. And there are people in my generation, you know, that don't want to have kids, you know, they don't want to follow their biological urge because some sort of technology that we use, that humans created, you know, to exchange value with each other is so flawed that makes them super nihilistic about the future. And I don't know, that when I realized that really just touched me, you know, where I was like, okay, that is crazy. Like this created technology is making it so that it blocks, in my opinion, the whole purpose of life, you know, the whole procreation. And that is just a very sad thing.
Yeah, I could not have put that more perfectly. And people don't realize or they don't connect the importance, the central importance and nature of money to what you just said, which is it. How many times a day when you get up in the morning, is money part of your decision? Like where you're going to eat? Are you going to have kids? It goes everything from whether you're going to have a hamburger to whether you're going to have a child. It's all affected by money. Mm-hmm. And in lives, you know, we see people going away from their families to earn money, and that time away is being defrayed and taken from them. But most people just think, oh, prices just go up. It's just what happens. But mm-hmm. I keep saying, no, the value of your currency keeps going down.
Yes.
And they say to me, you know, like Bitcoin's volatile. You know, what when it drops 20%? I said, you know, your fiat currency's dropped 100% nearly in the last one lifetime. Right? Like it's not maybe going to crash. It is crashed. It's done.
It's mathematically assured that it's going to lose value, right? So
it's just reflected in the inverse. It's reflected in the prices going up rather than the price dropping. Mm-hmm. People saw the value of their currency dropping in the same way they saw Bitcoin going up and down. But Bitcoin, as Peter Dunworth says, is volatile to the upside over time.
And maybe to add to that, right? Like, so the analogy that really helped me was, and I listened to a podcast that wasn't really about Bitcoin. It was more like a spiritual podcast, like about energy. And there was a guest, Nate Hagens, and he has really interesting thoughts just in general about energy, you know, the energy in the world, abundant energy, stuff like that. And he said, if you look around anything, you know, like in the room that you're in right now, anything you see costs energy to create or maintain. So I'm looking at books, you know, there's paper that comes from the trees and the tree grew because of the sun, you know, like it's everything, you know. If I look at the buildings outside, they were made with human energy, you know, and the bricks and the oven, and like just everything that you see costs energy to create or maintain, right? And if you view your life as something that has, again, like an absolute final amount of time, then there is also an absolute finite amount of energy that you can expend in that time, right? And so if that energy that you expend in that time, if you call that your productivity, you have a you have a finite productivity in an hour, in a day, in a week, in a month, in 5 years. And even as you're older, it will probably kind of like go down, right? So if I do something for you, I have a product or a service, and I expend energy in a certain amount of time, and I package that in a proposition, and you buy that from me for, let's say, $100, 100 units of the currency that you use. That those 100 units are basically an abstraction of that time and energy that I put into creating the whatever I'm selling you, right? Mm-hmm. And so I take that, and it's like a tool for humans to eventually, at another point in time and perhaps space, right, in another place, I want to spend that representation on something else that costs energy to create or maintain. But what you already know is that if you take your Aussie dollars to my country, nobody wants them, which is already interesting, right? So let's say I built something for you in Australia, and you give me $100, $100, and I come here and I want to buy the exact same thing. I couldn't even do that. Yeah, I just think that's an interesting thought. It's weird, because why would human productivity be valued in different ways based on the currency that you are using in a country? That doesn't really make sense. Like if there's someone in Singapore that could do, you know, my job better than me, you should be able to hire them too, or like reward them in the same way. But I digress a little, but this is connected to that. So if the money is an abstract representation of time and energy, think about if you connect that to human innovation, progression with technology, which is always happening, right? We went from monks writing with inked and feathers on paper to the book, the printing press. We went from manual labor to tools and horses, and eventually the tractors and the trains. And the technological progression is an innate part of human nature. So we get better and better at innovation, and I call that condensing compression of energy all the time, right? So if 10 monks could write 10 books in 10 days, you know, the printing press could print 10 books in 10 hours, you know, and so on and so on and so on. And now basically through the internet, all the information that ever existed is free. And now through AI, all the information that ever existed is accessible and applicable also for everyone, right? So that is continually just progressing basically. And as maybe you've talked about him before, but in the Bitcoin community, we have a guy called Jeff Booth, and he talks about, you know, the price of tomorrow. And he talks about how a technological innovation eventually drives prices down, right? He says, you know, technological innovation drives prices down to the marginal cost of production. Eventually, all the technology gets so accessible and is so democratized amongst all the people that there is not really an edge in making it, I don't want to say better, but it's at a certain point that it's accessible for everyone. And for example, you know, like I like the phone example. This is if you said that this to someone in the 60s, you know, they would have called you crazy. The fact that you have this crazy supercomputer in your pocket, right? Where, you know, if you look up pictures from the first like computer that had to be like loaded on a plane to be flown somewhere else, right? Like all that processing power is now just optimized and optimized and optimized, and you would now have like, I don't even know, millions of these types of computers in your hand, right? So you see that with and especially for millennials, I think the example is, for example, USB sticks or the memory cards, right? Like when they just came out, they were like 100 megabytes, 200 megabytes. Now, I don't know, like I have this 2 terabyte flash drive that's like this big now, right? So that is just how technology goes. And so if the technology is deflationary, drives prices down, and the products are more and more accessible, how does that battle with a money that is basically inflationary, right? There's more and more money created. And if you inflate the money supply, which is the real inflation, then the consequence is the price inflation. So if the amount of goods and services stay the same compared to more money units, then, you know, more money units chase the same amount of goods and services, so prices go up. But when you combine that with the energy part, right, if you think about, okay, a bread was maybe 50 cents in dollars 50 years ago. Now a bread is $3, $4, $5, $6. I don't even know, but way, way more. Do you think we've become better or worse at making bread in the past 50 years? Same for an apple. Does an apple, a general apple, need more energy from the sun and water from the rain, right, to be grown on a tree? You know, and the answer there is no. So the whole idea should be, you know, if you think about the Jetsons, you know, why isn't there a pill that I throw in the water and then poof, like a bread comes out, right? Like that's what you would expect if you think about 60 years of innovation in bread making. But the bread now is probably worse in nutrition, and you need more units of a currency to actually buy one bread. And so I always use this example because I think it's the best example, because there's so much time between, you know, 50 cents in 50 years and the bread now. If the bread is more expensive and has worse quality, which side of these two forces, the deflationary technology force and the inflationary money force, which side do you think is winning? You know, we should be progressing, and everything should become cheaper and more abundant, more accessible. Whereas, yeah, it kind of feels like we're going back in time. Like, when was the bread actually that expensive? Maybe 200 years ago, you know what I mean? And so I think that insight has also helped me a lot to understand why the money that we are forced to use is so broken that the prices go higher, and we are taught that that is good. Prices go higher, your wages go higher, etc., so you can still pay for it. But that is nominally correct, air quotes. But in real terms, yeah, you're basically getting poorer. And when I realized that, I think that's when I really went all in on Bitcoin.
Bram, thank you for that riff. That was incredibly powerful. I just want to apologize if there's been background noise on my side. I'm in an Airbnb above a pub in the middle of Madrid as we do this podcast.
Oh, wow.
And there are streets of people going by and somebody's banging something downstairs. So for the listeners, I'm trying to mute it out where I can. But if you hear these banging in the background, God knows what's going on.
I don't hear it. I think you're okay.
Okay, must be just through my headphones. Bram, I just want to double-click on a couple of things you said there, because you know, there's a lot in that mind of yours, and I can see that you actually have really, truly gone down the rabbit hole and really thought deeply about what it is to be human and what it is to expend time and energy, and what it means when you get compensated for that time and energy, and how insipid it is if you are storing that abstraction of your time in a currency that is actually being deflated away. But I just want to double click on two things you said. Jack Mullers talks about this a lot. He talks about how everything in nature requires energy, right? Like you just said, the sun falls on the planet, all over the planet. We have rain, which is a form of energy. We have wave movement. We have all these things. But money is this thing that the governments have convinced us does not require energy for them. They just push a button and manufacture it inside of a computer ledger. And when people say Bitcoin has, it's just magic internet and money, we're like, no, actually, to get Bitcoin, you have to expend real energy. You have to convert sunlight. You have to convert real world energy into solving a real mathematical problem. And then you store it in the world's largest distributed, decentralized, most secure network in the world. Maybe you could speak to that just quickly. But I also want to just extend before you jump in there on that, Bram. You know, you talked about the price of a loaf of bread. A lot of our audience is Australians, and you could extend what Bram said about a loaf of bread to housing, because in Australia we have a housing shortage right now. It's a red hot topic. Young people today, the average price of a house in Australia is give or take $1 million Australian. But not only is it way more expensive than it was for their parents, like something like 13 or 14 times more expensive than their parents' houses, but the house is smaller, the block of land is smaller, the quality is lower. And what Bram's saying is, but this is against the backdrop of technology. Like, you can't tell me the building technology has not gotten way more efficient since our parents came about. Our logistics and our every aspect of building a home should have gotten cheaper. The technology on everything should have made it cheaper, but it hasn't. So when you see this inflation figure of whatever they tell us it is, you know, 3, 4, 5%, you know, hidden in there is this shrinkflation kind of element where the good or service they're describing is less quality or smaller. Yes. And we're seeing smaller goods and services, smaller goods in our supermarkets for more money. And we're seeing it in housing, food, everything. So it's really insipid. It's a real problem. So maybe you could just talk to that little bit about proof of work and energy and how that sort of is quite a spiritual thing and sacred to Bitcoin.
Yes. So if the thing that I'm spending my finite time and energy on, if the reward that I'm working for by expending my finite time and energy, which is gone forever after I do the work, is something that not only other people can create by the push of a button without doing any, without expending any energy for that, you know, that's already strange. But also when, you know, to go back to the example, if I have a proposition and that is something you want and you come to me and you say, hey, that's what I want. You know, you're asking $500 units for it, but I want to pay 300. And then I say, well, I'll do it for 400. And you say, okay. And we shake hands, you know, that we can do in freedom. But then when I do the work and the reward gets introduced, we are introducing a third party within that value exchange that we freely agreed upon, right? And it's good that you are spending your money, you know, many economists will agree with me, you know, because, and I got this from Seb Bunny, who wrote an amazing book, and he said, you know, all the money you have right now is worth the most right now. So even in 5 minutes, it's worth a tiny, tiny, tiny bit less. Right. So instead of focusing on your future and building towards your future, right, as we talked about before, if I can lower the uncertainty towards my future, I can actually do things that take time into the future. I can take a certain risk. I can follow a certain idea I have or a passion or an interest or, you know, whatever it is. It doesn't matter what that is. But by saving now, lowering your uncertainty towards the future, you can actually start building. But because all the money that you save right now is worth the most right now and slowly losing value, you are actually forced to consume, so to spend it. Again, there are economists that say, no, that's a good thing, that fuels the economy, etc. But that makes that I want to spend it now, unconsciously, right? I want to spend it now. And what do I want to spend it on? Well, we have, like, you can buy t-shirts for 80 cents on Temu or Shine or whatever, you know, it's fucking website. And I think the better example is, you, because you talked about building, I live in a 102-year-old house. I have, you cannot really see it, but I have like glass with lead, you know, and like a really nice door that has like frames, like they are decorated. And at that time, when the people that built this house, they were like, I'm going to spend a little bit more time making this like a nice door frame. That's not something that you see nowadays, right? Or like just the general, the doors are like four layers of wood just pressed together. But that is, and that's also something I learned along the way, like that's like a meme in Bitcoin. Like everything is downstream from the money, right? So if my intrinsic motivation to do whatever I do for my job or my venture just comes from me, you know, that's a good starting point. And I offer that and you want to have it, you know, like I just gave the example, and you agree, you know, so I solve a problem or a need for you. You agree. We agree to this value exchange. I start delivering my product or my service to you. That is a great thing. But when that reward is introduced that constantly loses its money, it changes not only my incentive as to like how good I do my work, but it also changes your incentive in the sense that, yeah, what am I going to spend it on, right? And once those positive incentives kind of like get corrupted, right? Because your incentive was, I need this product or service that Bram offers. And my incentive is I'm going to make the best product or service that I can offer. But when this reward that's constantly losing value is introduced, it kind of like shakes up our incentives. And it actually incentivizes me less to deliver actual value, because I know that the reward I'm getting is getting devalued. Does that make sense?
So yeah, and it's why.
So I'm not incentivized to do my best, basically.
Yes.
It's fast money and fast work in that sense.
And this is why, the one killer use case for alternative coins or altcoins has been stable coins, because what for large parts of the world, like Argentinians and Lebanon, when we had Tony Yazbek on the podcast, he talked about what happened in Lebanon. When they got this reward in their local currency, which would be Argentine pesos or Lebanese pounds, The first thing they wanted to do was convert it to a more stable currency, something that was going to hold its value like for longer than an hour, literally in hyperinflation environments, that's what happens. It's not slowly, slowly, it's quickly, quickly. And that's why people off-ramp their fiat currency to USDT or Bitcoin, to expose themselves. USDT is obviously pegged to the US dollar, which is still fiat currency, and Bitcoin is Bitcoin. And he made another interesting observation. Somebody says, and I'd like your interest, what do you say to people when they say, well, what are you talking about? If I convert my money to Bitcoin, it drops 20%. How's that storing my money?
Yeah.
What's your reaction to that? Yeah, I'll give you Tony's.
Yeah. Let's take two steps back. So I've talked to Tony too. He had 100% inflation one day to the other, which basically means everything is gone. Hmm. Right? So all the economic energy that he had stored by expending his finite time and finite time and physical energy was gone, literally gone. So I think what people need to realize is that where that happened, you think like, oh, Lebanon, okay, that's that is a fucked up country or whatever. The money that they use is the same money that we use, right? Like the principles of it are the same. So it's fiat.
It's just
money.
A question of timing, right? It's the same thing that's happening. Yes, it's just slower.
And so in the Western world, this is really hard to comprehend because our money just works, right? But what is crazy, I think, is that we need to realize that it works because we are taking advantage of a lot of other countries all around the world, right? Not only in the past, just pillaging all their supplies and killing their people, but we are basically exporting our currency across the world. The euro less than the dollar, which is the world reserve currency, right? So the whole petrodollar thing, America prints dollars and they buy real energy, real oil from the ground. Just think about that. This is so that's a great thing to do as America, right? But it's just wild that you can buy real world physical energy with something that's created from nothing, that has no value. There is no value in the US dollar, and then you can buy real energy. But the point here is that I think what people need to realize is that our money is no different than the Argentinian money or the Lebanese money. We are just lucky that we have been born in this place in the world, and that our money is stronger than those monies. But what you need to realize is that this has happened before in many, many, many places, not even 100% inflation, but 200 or a few thousand percent inflation, right? Like it's happened before, and it will happen to the euro and the dollar as well. That's, by the way, also why America is now so frantically trying to see how they can escape that. And they're doing that in a very brutal way again, but that's another conversation. But I think the point is you have to realize that this has happened before, and that what people have done in history is that they gravitate towards a better money. Once you realize that you are using a money that's losing its value constantly, it's mathematically assured to lose its value over time, and you are thinking about, okay, how do I lower the uncertainty towards my future? I'm a early 30s, mid 30s millennial. I want to build a family. I want to build my retirement, etc., realized that the number that your parents needed to retire is probably like 10 to 20 times less in units, euro or dollar units, than you would need to retire. And then if you make that calculation, you will realize that you will you have no retirement. So the point of saying this is that you have this problem now. The urgency is very high, and you need to understand that you need to move to another money, a better money. What is a better money? A better money is a harder money, a money that you cannot just create by the print of a button, right? Like a money that is not being debased into the future. And so that's kind of how I share the urgency for my generational peers, is, you know, like, this is a path that is not, it's not my opinion. This path is not my opinion. This path is assured, you know, like, this is where all fiat currencies eventually go. And you can look you can look into history. It has happened before to many smart people in quite some decent countries as well, right? Like, it's not about, it's not even about it. Like, this is just the path. And maybe to tie it back to like the homes, you know, like you said, in Australia. So you see the housing prices go up. And that is because people have been starting to use houses as money, as store of value for their economic energy, because they cannot do it in fiat money anymore. Yes, you can acquire more units, you can save more units of the money, but it loses value so quickly that people have been starting to look for alternative ways to store their value. And that's, I think, what distorts the housing market on one side, you know. So houses have become a tradable good, whereas, you know, houses are utility goods. You know, the whole purpose of a house is protection and privacy, etc. But it's not meant to be something that is traded, which I do think is part of the narrative that people are being sold, right? Like, oh, you buy a home, it goes up in value, then you buy another, you buy bigger, then, you know, you put your family.
Australia is the world champions at that, Brian. Yeah. I don't know if you realize that, but Australians are absolutely addicted to real estate, probably above any other country in the world. I've never seen anything like it.
But it's a cope. It's basically a cope, right? And I've heard different people talk about Australia, but also Canada, to be like one of the first countries where you will really see the failure of a fiat money in a Western country. And yeah, when you share that about the home prices, you know, in Sydney, I don't know what a million US Aussie dollars is. That's probably like half a million US, something like that.
It's higher in Sydney. I think it's 1.5 Aussie dollars. Oh, wow. So I think, in Brisbane, it's like a million. The major cities are about a million, and Sydney's probably 50%.
But in my country, the average home is 500,000 euros. So that's the same problem. So you have many people, millennials in their early 30s, that still either live at home with their parents, or they live together, you know, like the people in the Friends TV show, you know, they live together with roommates at 33. And again, 50 years ago at 33, or even at 23, people were married and had two children, you know, and one person working, and they had a car and a home and a car and a garden and all these things. And so it's like we are going backwards. And again, to drive down the point, is you need to understand that this is just the reality. I don't like that reality either, you know, but it is the case that you don't have a retirement, and you cannot lower your uncertainty towards the future and make plans and build whatever you want to build or do whatever you want to do within your own free will when you stick to the money that's losing its value all the time. That's is that an answer to the spiritual question? I don't know.
Yeah, it is. I'll add a little bit to it for the listeners. The first thing I just want to acknowledge you for, Brahm, and for, I want the listeners not to miss this, is this whole journey started when Brahm admitted that he didn't understand money. And so many people today just have this inability to admit that very basic thing, that they don't understand something, anything. You know, it's just, we feel stupid the minute we say we don't get it or we don't understand it. So the first step in positive change in any life is to ask for help, you know, and to accept, hey, I don't know about this thing. I need to understand this thing, and become the child, you know, and just kill the ego, because the ego is so expensive. But the The thing that I want to just drill on, just double click, because I know a lot of people still, because they are like a fish born in water. When you're born into a fiat world, you think 100% in fiat. And Jeff Booth does such a good job trying to educate people to start thinking in a different way and outside of the fiat system, which is collapsing. And Tony's response when somebody says, what do you mean, like store of value drops 20%? It drops 20% compared to fiat, but one Bitcoin is always one Bitcoin. It will never be diluted. It will never be, et cetera. But the other thing is it might drop 20% in a short time frame, but if you lower your time preference and zoom out and look at the trajectory of Bitcoin over time, nobody has bought Bitcoin and held it for more than 4 years and been behind. That hasn't happened. So when you can broaden your time, lower your time preference and think longer term, whereas if you look at fiat currency, no fiat currency has been worth more 4 years later that I'm aware of than what it was 4 years before, because inflation is baked into the system. It is absolutely 100% of the time worth less in 4 years than what it's worth today, whereas Bitcoin is the inverse of that. But people have such a now time preference because of the incentives in the current fiat system to get rid of your cash as quickly as possible that you touched on, and you are being played in the system. And this is why I hope people just start to really just, I just want to pick at your mind a little bit with bringing guests like Bram in who have clearly thought about this much more deeply than the average punter, to really start that journey, because most people can relate to Neo in the Matrix when he says, there's a splinter in your mind, you know something's wrong, but you just can't quite put your finger on it.
I'll add two things to that, because this is good, right? Because we were talking about the move to a better money. And so I think what is important to emphasize is that I don't see Bitcoin as an investment. I see, once I realized that I was operating in a money system that I didn't understand, where the money I was acquiring, the wealth I was acquiring, was losing value on purpose, and that I needed to take more risk next to the risk that I was taking to acquire the money, right, to mitigate that debasement, one, and to then even, you know, make more or invest. When I realized that there is money system B, money system Bitcoin, where that tool that I use to store my economic energy can never, ever be debased, right? There are only ever 21 million Bitcoin eventually in the year 2140. When I realized that these two things basically live, you know, they operate parallel to each other. The Bitcoin system is based on an absolute truth. You know, the ledger of Bitcoin contains the absolute truth of this money system, and it self audits itself every 10 minutes to see if it's still that truth layer. Once I realized that, I was like, okay, but I can just move. You know, it's not investing. It's just another way to store my wealth. And so I see Bitcoin as a savings technology that you can actually also exchange with other people. You know, this is a different discussion, but I think the use case of a better savings tool is the most apparent one right now. Once I realized that I could save in that, I moved. And so I don't see it as an investment. I see the price of Bitcoin is an exchange rate from the money that is Bitcoin with the other money.
It's like if you're an e-commerce company and you have a Wise account. Like, I use Wise when I travel to pay for all my stuff, right?
Yeah.
I get my funds and then I go, I think the Aussie dollar is going to get weaker against the US dollar. I'm going to convert it into US dollars.
That's a good point. Yeah, I use Wise too. But yeah, that's exactly what you're doing.
And the people, mindset.
Yeah. But you're also, if you don't realize this, you know, you're not doing that. But once you realize this and you're like, okay, I need to save my economic energy in units of Bitcoin, then it becomes an exchange rate. It's not an investment. I think that's a very important distinction to make. And so I think there was one part also with what you said, but also what was the second part you said?
I said that, you know, there's the one Bitcoin will always be one Bitcoin. And secondarily, that over a longer time frame, you see that it's volatile on the upside.
Yeah. So
nobody's lost money over 4 years.
Yeah. So, but the volatility, you mean volatility is market volatility, right? So, okay, what is the price of it? I see price as a proxy of understanding by people. That's how I see it, right? So, and think about it like this. A few years ago, you needed $3,000 units to buy one Bitcoin unit. Today, you need, well, sorry, $85,800 units to buy one unit of Bitcoin. So ask yourself, which one is the better money? Which one is stronger?
I love the example of, you know, the average house, you know, costs you 600 Bitcoin 5 years ago. Today, it costs
like
you six.
Seven. Yeah. So, and why is it hard? Oh, yeah. Now I remember. Why is it hard to view Bitcoin like this? It's because people think they need to be investors. No, you have to be a saver first, lower your uncertainty towards the future. And once you have that, you have time and space, physically, mentally, to figure out how can I make more of this. But you think that because your money loses value all the time, or many people think, that you should become an investor. Well, guess what? There are investors that trade the whole day and they have their own satellites to have less latency, to trade quicker. You know, they are playing the same game as you think you are playing when you come home from your job or your venture and you want to hang out with your spouse and your kids, but then you still have to like trade or get a financial advisor that trades for you. Like, don't get into that game. Just ignore that game. You know, choose a technology that can store your value, that of which the whole promise is twofold. Or, well, it's upholding the integrity of the base layer of truth of this money system, and following its computer protocol rules. One of them, the most important one, is there will never be more than 21 million Bitcoin. So one Bitcoin right now is also one Bitcoin in the future. 1 euro in the year 2000 is now 35 cents. That's the difference. That's the difference. And so I don't think it's about lowering your time preference. It's understanding that this new type of asset, way to store your economic energy, is in what they call the monetization phase. People are figuring out, what is this worth? You know, it goes to 110, down to 70, 85, you know, went to 69, back to 15, now, you know, then 110. People are figuring out, what is this? How do we, what's the exchange rate of this new asset with this other thing? So the more important thing is that you study not only what we talked about now, but only also why is one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin, and understand that this is the most asymmetric opportunity of your lifetime, based on publicly available information that you can actually take advantage of. It's very special that a new type of monetary asset is introduced in your life. You know, this is the first time in, like, I don't know, a few hundred years. Maybe
the excitement now is like, you know, we're starting. 5 years ago, it was very different to now. We've got a White House that is, you know, got Bitcoiners all through it. You know, we have. Yeah.
And they have the same
banks
problem.
And institutions. Yeah, totally.
They have the same problem, right? Because how do you lower the uncertainty towards the future as a country? How do you plan 50 or 100 years ahead? You cannot do that with a growing debt burden. And they know it, right? So that's why they are focused on that. But what I wanted to say is that the fiat money system also forces you to think about this exchange of economic energy as a zero-sum game, you know, with the whole trading, like, if I win, you lose, right? Like, that is the whole mentality in the fiat money system. That's why people are also mad at the billionaires and the greedy corporations, and like that is how people are programmed to think. And it's partially true, because if the incentives become perverse, you know, the people that have these incentives become predatory. Like, if I want to win and you lose, right? Like, it's very, very human, I'd say. And that's also why it's really hard to realize that we are actually living in a time where you can move to another system, where you can actually make use of what I think is the most important technological, most profound technological discovery of our lifetime, right? Like, you actually have that opportunity right now. And I love what you said about the ego and IQ test. I 100% agree. You know, this is not easy to understand, so you have to have some sort of intelligence and curiosity and motivation to go down this path. But the quicker you can realize that you are a subject in this financial system and not an actor, that you are basically the product that is being used or abused, right? Like all not nice words, I know. Once you realize that, you are not in good. Yes, exactly. So you will come at a point, and it could be a different types of insights where you understand that how you thought money worked or the financial system worked is not how it works, and it is actually working against you. And then at that point, you have two choices, like in the Matrix, like the red pill, blue pill.
Head on either, the Nebuchadnezzar.
Do I ignore? And this is why I think this is more also like a spiritual enhancement journey. Like, do I ignore this knowledge and pretend it's not true and still adhere myself to what I now know is a flawed and predatory system, and deal with all the consequences that come after making that choice, which is long-term pain, right? Or do I take a short-term pain, really, really integrate the disappointment, the anger, the sadness, you know, around being bamboozled, you know, being taught something that is not true, having acted in a system that you don't understand, to then open your eyes and search, because I'm not going to tell people to buy Bitcoin. You need to study Bitcoin to search for a possible solution to that predicament. My answer to that is you should study Bitcoin. Why is that the solution to this predicament that you're in? And I think this is how we should invite people to do their own work. Because again, I am a risk averse person. I am a control freak. You know, this is the most rational decision I've ever made in my lifetime. And it's made me happier. It's made me more positive towards the future. It's made me more live in the now and focus on building something in my life and deciding not to be just a consumer and buying shit I don't like to impress people that, buy shit that I don't need to impress people that I don't like all that stuff, you know, just you can let that go. That's why, yeah, exactly. With money that's not real that you don't have, yeah. And so that's, I think this is the way eventually to show and inspire people to do their own work. Like, we are not going to force anyone to adopt Bitcoin. Like, you have to make that decision yourself.
So, Bram, you've been very kind with your time. I know you have to run. Last question for you is, where should somebody start who has listened to this podcast today and gone, I need to learn about Bitcoin properly, not listen to my Uncle Sammy, who's, you know, telling me it's the bullshit and whatever. I need to actually do my own research. What resources do you point people to in your life to start their Bitcoin journey?
So I've curated 6 videos on startwithbitcoin.com. That after 10 plus years, I think are the 6 best videos to watch, where the first video, I think, is the most important one, and that's called What's the Problem? And that's an excellent explanation. It's only 39 minutes or something, this video. So if this conversation triggered you, then, well, I think you can spend 39 minutes to check out that explanation. And it shows the difference between having a money that you can not just create and having, in this story, they use a big red button that just creates more units of money, and it shows what the consequences eventually are. And we touched upon some in this conversation. I think that is the best starting video. And then I curated like 5 other videos that people can go through, also differences between Bitcoin and crypto. And so, yeah, start with bitcoin.com. Check out 6 videos.
And I assume they'll find your YouTube channel there as well. Yeah.
I think I put on my X link, and my YouTube channel is Bitcoin Bram, or you can search for Bitcoin for Millennials on YouTube or any podcasting app.
Terrific. Bram, thank you for your time. I may have got closer to saying your name right by the end of it instead of my Aussie Bram at the start.
Perfect. Both fine.
Mate, we really appreciate you on behalf of everybody that has heard this today. I know that somebody will be listening to this on their way to a job that they don't like, knowing that they're getting robbed at the same time, and it could really change their life. So I'm very grateful for you to take your time out and share your wisdom with us. And, mate, I look forward to seeing you hopefully at a conference. I'm going to be at Bitcoin Prague and Vegas coming up. If you're at either of those, I'd love to say good day and connect.
I'll be in Vegas and maybe in Prague. So, yeah, thanks. Oh, cool. Thanks for the invitation. And, yeah, man, happy to chat. Thank you.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.